Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 99, Stan and Oily. Geopolitical Tragicomedy, Part 4. Continuing to read from Pepe Escobar's book, Globalist Stan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War, published by Nimble Books. Now, an editorial note, this show was recorded before chaos and horror breaking out in Gaza, with Israel, Palestine, etc. So, interestingly, the first chapter in the show has to do with Israel. It's called Eretz Israel Meets Arabistan. There's a quote, beginning of the chapter, from Golda Meir, Israeli Prime Minister, 1970. There are no Palestinians. Chapter in this show, Talibanistan. And one of the quotes at the beginning is a Kabul Persian proverb. It's the same donkey, but with a new saddle. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Chapter 8, Eretz, Israel Meets Arabistan. Looking up Eretz on Wikipedia, the land of Israel, Hebrew, Erez Yisrael. Eretz is Yisrael is a biblical name for the territory roughly corresponding to the area encompassed by the southern Levant. Related biblical, religious, and historical English terms include the land of Canaan, the Promised Land, the Holy Land, and Palestine. So, without studying this stuff, I can see where a bit of the rub is there. Steve Newcomb's book, discussing the pagans in the Promised Land, talks about how that sort of Jewish, or the blueprint of the Promised Land was some of the roots of the doctrine of Christian discovery. So that's interesting stuff. Anyway, let's see, beginning with this chapter, August 14, 2006, a flimsy, delayed UN-brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah starts to apply in Lebanon. Future historians may well remember it as the day the intractable Arab-Israeli conflict was turned upside down. Strategically, Israel had just allowed the emergence of a formidable drone of the Dome of the Rock of an enemy. Arab self-belief and pride, something no Arab army had been able to deliver thus far. The psychological blow for Israel was cataclysmic. Sheikh Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, proclaimed a strategic historic victory. Klaus Witz from his perch in geopolitical heaven would certainly define it as a tactical, operational, and strategic victory, although the price paid was horrific. 1 million homeless Lebanese, thousands killed or maimed, and relentless savage destruction of Lebanon's infrastructure. And then it goes on, the rise of political Islam in the Mideast was now more than reestablished, and all according to the rules of the game via elections. Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement in Palestine, the Shiite religious parties in Iraq, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but in what sense Nasrallah could be regarded as the new Nasser? The Muslim Brotherhood was born in Egypt in 1928. Nasser, who regarded himself as a hero of Arab socialism, lost the 1967 war to Israel. But what Israel managed to do at the time transcended a mere military victory. It smashed secular Arab nationalism to pieces. Where else to turn for solace? Egyptians and most of the Arab street turned to Islam. That's when the Muslim Brotherhood, though still outlawed, started to rise again, brandishing its famous slogan, Islam is the solution. 4 decades later, both Arab socialism and neoliberalism had thunderously failed to elevate the standard of living of the Arab street. Now Nasrallah was showing there is a third way. It is political Islam, yes, playing the representative democracy rules, not tainted by corruption and profoundly implicated in social work. And all this hummus spiced with an indigenous Arab resistance movement winning a war against the supposedly invincible Israeli military machine. Now, this seems to give some of the roots of the Islamicness, dissatisfaction going on today. And a little further on, impasse will remain a fact on the ground, with no evidence in the near future that Hezbollah would agree to disarm under UN Security Council resolutions 1559 and 1701, as much as Israel would not respect UN's impasse will remain a fact on the ground with no evidence in the near future that Hezbollah would agree to disarm under UN Security Council resolutions 1559 and 1701, as much as Israel would not respect UN Security Council resolution 242, which determines it should return all the Arab lands occupied in 1967. Israel created both Hamas and Hezbollah. Hamas developed in Palestine as a counterpower to the hegemonic and corrupt PLO. Hezbollah developed to fight Israel's 1982 invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon. Both Hamas and Hezbollah are indigenous, seriously organized and disciplined resistance movements enjoying widespread local popular appeal because of their dedicated social work and because they are not tainted by corruption. It's hard to believe that in 2006 Lebanon war, Israel failed in all its objectives, from killing Nasrallah, preventing missiles being fired on its territory, and totally destroying Hezbollah's military power, to occupying the region south of the Litani River, showing off its military might to remind all Arabs that resistance is impossible, and intimidating both Syria and Iran. The British Mines Advisory Group, a Manchester-based charity, accused Israel of extreme carpet bombing, showering southern Lebanese villages with cluster bombs, a carpet in fact thicker than the one deployed in the U.S. invasion of Iraq. This forced the indefatigable Jan Egeland, the UN's humanitarian chief, to stress that what's shocking, and I would say to me completely immoral, is that 90% of the cluster bomb strikes occurred in the last 72 hours of the conflict, when we knew there would be a resolution. At least 100,000 unexploded cluster bombs will keep maiming, wounding, and killing mostly poor southern Lebanese Shiites for years to come. Whew, sad stuff. Now that reminded me of World War II with the, from what I had heard a while ago with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, how the war, it was already a done deal, and in essence the bombings were unnecessary. So that, you know, that again attests to the twisted machismo. Israel's logic in southern Lebanon replicated in frightening detail the Pentagon logic applied in late 2004 in Fallujah. Let's destroy it in order to save it. As in Fallujah, the scorched earth tactics amounted to ethnic cleansing of poor Sunni Arabs. In southern Lebanon, scorched earth tactics amounted to ethnic cleansing of poor Shiites. In both cases, humanitarian help was not allowed, and civilians were expendable collateral damage. Call it the preferred modus operandi of liquid war. You know, the scorched earth phrase, that reminded me of first hearing from indigenous people how a lot of what's going on is really, it's not about this people against that people. It's about a war on Mother Earth. And if we get past that, you know, dualistic man-on-man thing, Republican-Democrat kind of thing, we can see the bigger picture. Continuing, there was a stupor in some circles over why the Bush administration itself bombed the Cedar Revolution it fought so hard for, and why it allowed the incineration of any remaining U.S. credibility in the Islamic world. It took the New Yorker's investigative icon Seymour Hersh once again to conclusively prove that Israel's Kosovo-style offensive had been planned and presented in Washington more than a year before the fact as a sort of dry run for a Bush administration war on Iran. Dick Cheney's point, as a former senior intelligence official told Hersh, was, quote, "What if the Israelis execute their part of this first, and it's really successful? It'd be great. We can learn what to do in Iran by watching what the Israelis do in Lebanon," end quote. It all went, once again, spectacularly wrong. Iran's Revolutionary Guards were sufficiently alert to grasp the implication. The logic sequence runs like this. Afghanistan as a dry run, augmented with shock and awe for Iraq. Gaza as a dry one for Fallujah. Shock and awe plus Fallujah as a dry run for Lebanon. Lebanon as a dry run for Iran. If the Pentagon were a result-oriented corporation by now, its controllers would have established that the shock and awe video gaming model simply does not defeat nationalist-fueled asymmetric war. Any couple of paragraphs later on. So in the end, what was this? The sixth Arab-Israeli war, the third Palestinian Intifada, the good old war on terror, the first salvo of the long war. What the 2006 Lebanon war did was to calcify the geopolitical birth pangs of not a greater Middle East, but a greater West Asia, which was always there in the first place, as all the turmoil in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, and Israel-Palestine has always been interconnected. The Afghan model, bombing plus puppet government plus no nation building equals widespread chaos, was replicated in Iraq. The Pakistani ISI has always supported Salafi jihadists in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and is closely connected to the jihad in the Middle East. Neo-Pan-Arabism and Pan-Islamism are the new burning ideals across West Asia, from the Levant via the Persian Gulf to South Asia. And a little summary here. Overall prevails the configuration of liquid war, a seamless matrix of deranged flux pitting rogue, unstable, or regional hegemonic states against each other, non-state radical Islam against the West, nuclear powers against aspiring nuclear powers, long-lasting social and political grievances against autocratic repression, a minority of insiders against the vast masses of the excluded, and all those hidden agendas swirling like mad in the grand bazaar of Pipelineistan. And Pepe then goes on to say, the point is that if Israel eventually decided to abandon its configuration as a neo-Sparta guided by exclusive military logic, all the elements, intellectual expertise, business savvy, global connections would be there for it to dazzle and shine as the neo-Athens of the Middle East. Israel could be infinitely more successful than Dubai if it shelved what amounts to a land-grabbing war ethos. Gaza and the West Bank would be integrated in a two-tiered service sector. There would be a perpetual summer rain over the West Bank, not of bullets, but foreign aid and investment. But this won't happen as long as the IDF remains the most powerful institution by far in Israeli society. Now, he mentions a little later on, Urushalam, or Urushalim, U-R-U-S. H-A-L-I-M was already inscribed in Egyptian statuettes in 2500 B.C., but in its last 2,000 years of history, it was never the eternal and indivisible capital of Israel, the official mantra since 1967. The history of Jerusalem is above all a history of foreign domination. That sounds like the original spelling of one of the original spellings, Urushalim. So that'd be interesting to look up, see what that actually means. And here's something. Jerusalem, in fact, is a word of Canaanite derivation, the prefix uru meaning founded by, and the suffix salam or shalam. So I guess that would be Phoenician Canaanite god of dusk. This evidence is reinforced by archaeology and by tablets found in Elba, Syria, dating back to 3000 BC. Interesting, this, the land of the place of dusk, founded by dusk. Interesting. So this chapter gets further into the Arab-Israeli conflict, PLO, and obviously a difficult area to resolutions. Man, the water issue has been a big deal in with Israel and Palestine. And here Escobar writes, "You have to buy most of your water from Israeli water companies while the Israelis keep pumping more water from the West Bank aquifer, which was your property. Kiss goodbye to 83% of your water resources. Your natural gas off Gaza is managed by an Israeli company. You don't get a cent. Your problems are invisible in the Israeli and world mainstream media. Thoughtful World Bank reports sanitize your life, saying that you face a year of unprecedented economic recession or some other platitude. The relentless construction of the separation wall is invisible. It's not even a wall. It's a barrier, a fence, or a security barrier." And there was a recent little documentary I saw where some sacred area in Palestine, ancient in showing the really indigenous way of being of the Palestinians, that there was a vote to preserve that area. I forget the name, but it's some kind of area that's essential to their growing and the gardening and the orchards and such like. Open up this chapter. If you are in Gaza, you live in an 8 kilometer wide and 23 kilometer long strip of extremely arid land by the Mediterranean, crammed with other 1.5 million people, at least half of them refugees, the highest population density on earth. There's a 33% chance you live in a refugee camp like sprawling Jabalaya. There's a 50% chance that you are not yet a 15-year-old, but you have a 30% chance of being unemployed, a 50% chance of living below the poverty line, and a 40% chance of having no sewage system. You're likely to have access to only a few drops of water a day at the most. Your Israeli missiles destroyed a lot of your pipelines and pumping stations. 70% of your orange groves were also destroyed, replaced by security zones. Carnations and strawberries, two of your main exports, were left to rot. But Israel makes a lot of money with your vegetables cultivated in your land. 60% of all exported vegetables actually end up in UK supermarkets. Your electric power station was bombed, so now you have less electricity than Baghdad, which is also part of Planet Gaza anyway. Your food is imported from Israel. Any imposition of collective punishment to harm terrorists means that you starve. Yours per capita annual income, if you're lucky, is US 700 at best. In Israel, it's US 20,000 and up. In a nutshell, you live on the ground zero of humanitarian crisis, an open-air, fetid concentration camp, ethnic cleansed in slow-mo. That, some of the stats and conditions are not dissimilar to the poor worldwide and some of the native reservations. In the last couple paragraphs of this chapter, "Yet if you or anybody else had enough of this and decided to engage in suicide bombing in utter desperation, there will be a, quote, response. The response will always be collective punishment. Everyone has to pay because everyone is a terrorist. Your land will be invaded over and over again. You may be killed by Israeli snipers. And if you or anyone anywhere on earth, for that matter, even mildly criticize any piece of this hellish machine, you're guilty of anti-Semitism and dismissed as a lunatic. By any definition, this is Conrad's the horror, right here, right now. But let us dream. The horror might disappear overnight if only Israel returned the Golan to Syria, the Sheba farms to Lebanon and Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem to Palestine. Systemic raping and pillaging of the enslaved West Bank plus bombing enslaved Gaza to the Neolithic will only breed unimaginable hatred and inevitably engender blowback after blowback. Let us dream of the day the U.S. managing elite finds out that return of occupied Arab lands is the obvious solution for virtually all of the U.S.'s problems in the Arab and Islamic world, for neutralizing the terrorism sequential bomb, and for igniting the beginning of a golden age for the Middle East. Let us stop. Wake up, you fool. There's a long, infinite, liquid war going on." It's something to read it out loud. I find that obviously with poetry, but Pepe's writing style just flows like epic poetry, and more of his emotions come through, and I can sense that the justified anger, and then the idealist in him, and then the realist or the practical, what's really going on, but emotions come through, and it is a real testament to reading stuff out loud once in a while, even amongst your friends or whoever. It really does make the literature alive in a different way. in chapter 9, Talibanistan, starts off with quotes, Pashtun mystic poet Banawa from the Kohistan Twilight. These may be the pages of history telling stories of the haloed Bamiyan. It may be the dust that flies, taking tribute from the skies. And he has a quote from William Blake, Proverbs of Hell, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. And a Kabul Persian proverb, it's the same donkey, but with a new saddle. I think I read that quote in excellent book, A Woman Among Warlords by Malalai Joya, which is not her real name. Excellent book for understanding the plight of the Afghanistanis, and especially the, you know, from the women's perspective, as that was one of the things supposedly going over there to, I think maybe it was Hillary Clinton that was said that to, among others, you know, going over there to free the women and let them have democracy. There's a lot going on in the Talibanistan chapter. Just going to skip around and read some of the highlights. In early December, I would also see Pir Baksh Bardiwal, the man responsible for intelligence operations in eastern Afghanistan, absolutely puzzled. Why didn't the Pentagon block all the obvious exit trails from Tora Bora when any of Hazrat Ali's Mujahideen, paid by the U.S., knew them by heart? Only a few Arab Al-Qaeda fighters were captured in Tora Bora after Osama had left. Later, they were sent to the Ninth Circle of Dante's Hell in Gitmo, along with dozens of Afghan bystanders. Most Al-Qaeda fighters that remained in Tora Bora died in battle as martyrs buried under the rubble caused by bunker buster bombs. As far as the American military were concerned, Pir Baksh was adamant Al-Qaeda escaped right out from under their feet. So it was a major Pentagon blunder. It was a major Donald Rumsfeld, Tommy Franks blunder. It was a major White House blunder, and there were two reasons for it. First, the Pentagon outsourced the war in eastern Afghanistan to the wrong warlords, who were collecting suitcases full of cash with one hand and spreading disinformation with the other. Second, the White House and the Pentagon's attention were already directed towards toppling Saddam. So, yeah, that brings up how much did they really want to get Osama, even if Osama was alive. I mean, after he was supposedly killed by that Navy SEALs or whoever the heck went into the compound, there was an article reporting that he had passed away in, I don't know, 2003 or something. So the whole thing is suspicious, and then his body being dumped into the water, you know, added to the suspicion. And some of it was, you know, tragic comedy, this thing with this guy supposedly on a dialysis machine after the 9/11 bombings, that the mastermind on dialysis was escaping through the caves of Tora Bora. I mean you couldn't write a stranger script. And Pepe at one point describes going along for a ride with certain people. I'm not sure if this is the chapter, but he definitely, you know, gets the journalist perspective. Here he has tribalism as Afghanistan's way of life, but Massoud refused the notion that all the troubles in Afghanistan were tribal-related. Quote, for example, exiled King Zahir Shah is Pashtun, and he cannot live under the Taliban. In the same breath, we have some Tajiks who cannot live with us. The tribal problems that exist now are intensified by Pakistan, end quote. So, inevitably, Massoud did not trust President Musharraf, who was trying hard to project a moderate image. Quote, he is following the same line of his military from General Zia to now, end quote. His obsessive dream was really more democracy for Afghanistan. In the unlikely event of a referendum in the near future, he said, depending on the time of the election, most of the population of Afghanistan would vote for a political national party who would have the power to reconstruct the country. For him, the future has to be solved through only one way, democracy. So again, like the Middle East, here we got the Taliban, the Pakistan, Afghanistan, all these different sects and stuff going on. This little section here, this could only happen, of course, if he was capable of reconquering Afghanistan. Quote, I am not waging war against the Taliban, I'm at war with Pakistan, end quote. Massoud was certain that 40% of people in the front lines are not Afghans, they are foreigners, mostly Pakistani military, Taliban educated in Pakistani madrasas, and Saudis faithful to Osama bin Laden. These can come from all over, since Osama issued a worldwide appeal for, quote, good Muslims to come to Afghanistan to engage in a jihad. So along with Russians, Americans, Chinese, and everybody else, Massoud was also clearly worried about the possible Talibanization of Central Asia. And much of this has been reported a fair amount. These, quote, governments were governments in name only. Warlords at the time wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and created the conditions for the emergence of the Taliban. Another thing still going on, how much the warlords are really in control. And he lists Pashtun or Pathan, the largest tribal society on earth. Here, Buddhism was refined and catapulted to Asia through the snowy Karakoram peaks. Peshawar literally means city of flowers. From here, the Pakistani government maintains a fragile control over the Pashtun or Pathan, the largest tribal society on earth. And this is sort of, this talks about it's pretty self-explanatory, but goes back some years. The Taliban must have had a ball in Houston when they visited the control tower of Planet Oil in 1997 to negotiate the Trans-Afghan pipeline. They also visited Unocal in Sugar Land, Texas. We can imagine Mullah Omar's finest in full black turban regalia at the Houston Galleria amid all those blonde, dermatologically sublime trophy wives credit carding their way to the Valhalla of conspicuous consumption at Saks, Macy's, Nordstrom, and Neiman Marcus. Not to mention the red meat feast in all those steakhouses and the sexy groan of all those SUVs, from Kandahar-friendly Toyota Land Cruisers to Durangos, Silverados, Discoveries, Cayennas, and even BMWs. Of course, this was ages before the cluster bombing of the Taliban back to Jurassic Park became the secret casus belli for the war on terror after 9/11. Between the Taliban taking over Kabul on September 1996 and the G8 summit in the summer of 2001, both the Clinton and Bush administrations never designated Afghanistan as a terrorist or even a rogue state. The Taliban were wined and dined as long as they played the Pipelinistan game. Unocal, which had put the sent gas pipeline consortium in place, hired Henry Kissinger as a consultant. Yeah, that goes on and on. The ins and outs of who's the revolving door and the hypocrisy. You know, you study enough history, even 10, 20 years, you get to see the hypocrisy of stuff. Not to mention the New York Times on May 26, 1997, the paper of record in full Pipelinistan mode printed that, quote, the Clinton administration has taken the view that the Taliban victory would act as a counterweight in Iran and would offer the possibility of new trade routes that could weaken Russian and Iranian influence in the region. End quote. As everyone knows, Karzai later became Afghanistan's puppet ruler, and Khalilzad also made splendid career moves. Bush appointed National Security Council member working under Condoleezza Rice, special envoy to Afghanistan, only 9 days after the Karzai government was sworn in, U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan, and U.S. ambassador in Iraq. The whole problem is that the Taliban didn't want to play ball. What they wanted was more money and more investments for the roads and the infrastructure of ravaged Afghanistan. This went on until the exasperated Washington decided to finish them off. The details were discussed in Geneva in May 2001 at the G8 summit in Genoa in July 2001 and finally at a secret meeting in a Berlin hotel also in July and involving American, Russian, German, and Pakistani officials. I would later learn in Islamabad that the American plan was to strike against the Taliban from bases in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan before October 2001. This was a complement to the Get Osama plot that provoked Musharraf's insomnia. But then came 9/11, providing Washington the perfect excuse to go it alone. There's still no Pipelinistan in Afghanistan, and there won't be for years to come. The Taliban will fight to their death not to let it happen. If it happens, it has to be under their terms. Underestimating the Pashtun is always a big cultural mistake. Their very long memory spans centuries. In the Pashtunwali tribal code, there are two supreme values, utmost loyalty and implacable revenge. Betrayal is simply unforgivable. As the Taliban are essentially Pashtun, although not every Pashtun is a Taliban, Washington's actions have engendered implacable enemies for generations. Bring it on, claimed George W. Bush. Oh, they will bring it on, nonstop, forever. That's the last three or four words there, or one word sentence with the period. So again, as a previous show talking about Vietnam and understanding the psychology of a people, in your personal life or especially on this geopolitical chessboard is really essential, it seems. In one other little section to the end of this chapter, it's got a subsection header spelled I, and then about 10 I, T-S, it's back, the Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan. It starts off, it's unlikely dashing black turban Pashtun with coal-rimmed eyes will be parking their brand new SUVs at the Houston Galleria anytime soon. But everyone caught in the hypnotic grip of Afghanistan's tortuous history saw this one coming. The Taliban proclaiming the Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan remixed, this time in the southwest. The U.S. had certainly promoted the, quote, liberation of private enterprise in post-Taliban Afghanistan. The liberation was also parallel to an orgy of lawlessness smelling a gold mine. Afghani farmers had to come up with the great idea of sowing poppy all over the country again. Arif Jamal, arguably the top Pakistani expert on jihad, went to eastern Afghanistan in the summer of 2002 as a reporter and met nothing other than the rebirth of Narcoland. He found the country's second biggest opium market. By mid-2005, the Pedram had had enough of U.S. and U.K. promises of eradicating drug cultivation after confirming that everyone, including Hamid Karzai's younger brother, was directly involved in trafficking. The Taliban were literally back in town. Pedram was as horrified by the return of the good Taliban as by the regrouping of the bad Taliban in the east and southeast, while the frustration of the people is more and more palpable in a Kabul eerily reminiscent of Baghdad, without electricity or water. Hail, globalistan. Half of Kabul still looks like Dresden, but now an expat with an expense account can choose among more than 80 brothels. And a little bit farther on in there, don't stop till we get enough mode. The Taliban's crucial move could not be a back-to-the-80s revival. The launch of an Afghani intifada, actually an Islamic Afghan intifada, as it's known across Talibanistan. As blowbacks go, this one was a given. At the U.S. fabricated Jihad Incorporated in the 1980s in Afghanistan, Jihad Incorporated resurrects 2 decades later to fight the U.S. Call it a post-mod remix of Michael Jackson's Thriller. And yes, it's a global affair, pan-Islamic, not restricted to the Kandahar plains and the Hindu Kush. The Quincy Jones of this new collection of jihadi hits could not but be Ayman al-Zahawiri himself. I just had to read that for his cultural music references. Haq Yar told Shanzid that the whole Islamic world is waiting for the revival of the Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan, but it will take some time. He revealed what by the fall of 2006 had become obvious. We now have established a network under which we are allied with many big and small Mujahideen organizations. This explained how the Taliban could deploy their firepower simultaneously in the south and also in the east. It's interesting that Haq Yar, defines Al-Qaeda as partners with a significant role, not the mastermind of this Afghan and global jihad remixed. Wherever Mujahideen are resisting the forces of evil, Arab Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, and leaders Osama bin Laden and Dr. al-Zawahiri have a key role. So for the Pashtun Taliban, the whole point is exactly similar to the 1980s, a jihad to expel a foreign invader, then the USSR, now the US and NATO. Will the West ever learn? Again, that even reading a little bit of recent history, seeing the repeated patterns, the enemies become friends, become enemies, become friends, and it's a cycle that hopefully can be mitigated soon. And wrapping up this chapter, he refers to the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, TAP, T-A-P, pipeline. That is, Pipelinistan. The only reason why Afghanistan matters in the long war worldview remains the same one when the Taliban rose to power, as a transit corridor for TAP from Turkmenistan to Baluchistan and eventually India. The Asian Development Bank may even approve TAP, 2,000 kilometers long at an estimated cost of US $3 billion, but possibly reaching $7 billion to be completed by 2010. But the only way for TAP to be profitable is with India as a final destination, and Delhi knows its best bet for natural gas is from Iran and the second best from Qatar. Hamid Karzai wants TAP by all means, not TAP in itself, but the badly needed US $300 million a year he could collect in transit fees. In Pakistan, the independentist Baluchistan Liberation Army, BLA, would certainly raise some hell to get a piece of the action. Taliban also have TAP on their sights, but for more ballistic motives, if there ever was a TAP, it would be very easy for the Taliban to smash it to pieces every week. Sunni Arab guerrilla in Iraq style, either in southwest Afghanistan or in Baluchistan. Russia, in fact, all but killed TAP, as we've seen in the Pipelinistan chapter. With no TAP, the regional winner, once again, is Iranian Pipelinistan, totally incorporated to the Asian energy security grid with China and India. The U.S. could always deploy NATO forever in Afghanistan to assure a hypothetical TAP security. The Taliban would forever relish the prospect as much as their daily banquet of kebab, chicken, rice. And that's up through chapter 9. Again, it reminds me of that, some of the best laid plans, these plans to control the oil, control the gas, the resources, connect the countries. At some levels, there's an efficiency to it, and then there's a bit of the chaos, as we're seeing in Iraq now, with various, factors and sections taking over, and whether the oil fields can be controlled. So as much as it seems planned and organized, there's elements of chaos. So that's already up to 168 pages through the book. So pretty much about halfway. So perhaps an indication of how long this series will go. The next chapter will be chapter 10, Shiitistan. Thanks again for listening. Take care. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a few minutes off of a 2 hour and 48 minute piece on YouTube called Relaxing Spa Music Sound Therapy for Relaxation Middle Eastern Atmospheric. 'Cause that's some of what's needed over there.